Welcome inside the guard. I am your host, TP Grant, and today we are going to be talking about UFC on Fox 14, Anthony Johnson versus Alexander Gustafsson.
It really was an interesting night of fights as the UFC went into Stockholm, Sweden with a card that was just loaded up with talent, specifically European talent, a lot of young or kind of up-and-coming fighters from the European scene getting their shot, with a couple big names mixed in, specifically at the top of the card. And overall, it was a fun night of fights. I don't think a lot of people really walked away from this one feeling like their time was wasted, unless you were a Swedish fan and you watched all the Swedish fighters on this card lose rather dramatically, and that probably wasn't necessarily fun. Now, the purpose of this show is to have an ability to take a bigger picture look at events with a little bit of perspective. I'm recording this the Sunday after the event, and there are tons and tons of great recap shows and instant reaction shows that go over events. The Sure Dog Radio Network's Beat Down After the Bell. At Bloody Elbow, we obviously have the sixth round with Kid Nate Wilcox and Zane Simon, and occasionally Conor Rebush. And those are all fantastic and fine. The purpose of this show is kind of a little bit more of a stepped back look, kind of more in line with what my Sunday perspective pieces that I did on Bloody Elbow were, but without the spelling and grammar errors that come with the fact that I was either writing it at 2 in the morning or really early on a Sunday morning before going off to jiu-jitsu training. So we're going to start off with kind of a bigger picture look because the light heavyweight division just it got reordered in one night, it really seemed like. With just two fights, the upper tiers of the UFC light heavyweight division got a tremendous shakeup. Anthony Rumble Johnson handed Alexander Gustafsson the most decisive loss of his career and has earned for himself the title of number one contender for John Jones' light heavyweight championship. And then earlier in the card, Ryan Bader and Phil Davis had a bout that, to refer to it as uninspired would be somewhat charitable, but it still represents Ryan Bader's first win over a top five opponent. And as per both the official, air quotes, UFC rankings and the SureDog.com light heavyweight rankings. And that's a pretty big step for Bader. And kind of going back to the main event, coming into the evening, Johnson was viewed as the underdog. And many expected Gustafsson to outstrike Johnson en route to what we all hoped would be a dramatic rematch with John Jones. But the drubbing that Rumble put on Alexander Gustafsson really forces us to kind of go back and reevaluate, at least those of us that were picking Gustafsson to win. And I coming in did expect him to win, though I was expecting a very, very good fight. And I don't feel I was underselling Rumble coming into this. I think one thing going back and looking at it is that Gustafsson is not really a defensively sound fighter. He gets hit often and really covers up a lot of his defensive shortcomings with a really withering offensive output of his own. Now, kind of going to the fight metric, and obviously there are problems with striking statistics in MMA. They aren't perfect, but especially when you look at the career of a fighter, you can get kind of a broad sense of what kind of fighter they are, at least in terms of on the feet or really from a striking perspective. And Gustafsson's defensive numbers just aren't very good. Throughout his UFC career, he has defended, meaning that he has successfully stopped a significant strike from landing, less than half the time. And amongst elite fighters, that's not very good. His number is actually at 47%. And when you're talking about elite strikers and elite fighters, you get guys who are definitely over half, and many of the good strikers tend to be over 60%, and then like the truly elite, the Anderson Silvas and Jose Aldos, are in the upper 60s or around 70%. And then even more troubling is the fact that in the significant strikes, absorbed per minute, Gustafsson is sitting at 3.38, which is a really high rate of getting hit. And now, obviously, these are averages across all fights, and fights are different, and there's strikes to on the ground to be accounted for. But just speaking again from like looking at elite level fighters, that 3.38 is a very, very high number, and it suggests that Gustafsson is rather hittable. And then you pair him with Anthony Johnson, who's actually a very accurate striker and a very powerful striker for his entire career. And, well, you saw the results, and they weren't very pretty. And Rumble Johnson's always been one of the premier striking talents in MMA, even going back to his early welterweight run, which is so long ago now, when he was knocking out the likes of Chad Reiner or Tommy Spear or Kevin Burns. And now you talk about the fact that Anthony Johnson is working with Henry Hooft, the head striking trainer at the Black Zillions, who is an incredibly accomplished kickboxer in his own right. And that's really been paying dividends as Johnson's striking game continues to become more and more polished. Hooft isn't really often talked about, but he's really having an impact with the Black Zillions that's not unlike what Dwayne Ludwig had with Team Alpha Male, and it's just not getting the same amount of attention as Ludwig's run with Alpha Male. And Johnson's at a really interesting point in his career because he's at the 9-year point of fighting professionally. And Patrick Wyman, a friend of mine, writer for Sure Dog, used to write for Bloody Elbow, has really done some work with aging curves in MMA. And obviously the data that we have right now, he's not entirely happy with because it's still a young sport. But he generally finds that, you know, elite fighters tend to have about 9 years from their professional debut of high-level fighting. And then it can be extended on after that based on how much damage they take, how they're training, if they're training intelligently, things like that. And Johnson's kind of hit that point where he's in that sweet spot. He's currently 30 years old and very much looks like the peak of his fighting career. He's still in his physical prime. He hasn't taken a huge amount of damage throughout his career. I mean, not counting like the eye pokes that he took against Kevin Burns and things like that. But he's not put a ton of wear and tear on his bodies. And he's kind of hitting that perfect little spot of fighting experience, technical knowledge, and physical ability that makes him a really threatening fighter. He is at the peak of his fighting career right now. And it'll be very interesting to see if he is the guy to pry the title away from an increasingly distracted John Jones. Because while I feel Jones likely is the favorite in that fight, and rightly so, because John Jones has just proven himself time and again to be the best light heavyweight in the world, you can't sleep on Anthony Johnson's power. That's some pretty serious power he's packing. We've never seen Alexander Gustafsson kind of stumbling around and hurt like that. So it's a very intriguing matchup. I look forward to it. It should be a really excellent fight. In terms of where this leaves the light heavyweight division, I mean, clearly John Jones, as I just said, is a cut above the competition in terms of accomplishment and just in terms of ability inside the ring. But Anthony Johnson has definitely earned entry into that next tier of fighter alongside the man he just dispatched, Alexander Gustafsson, and Daniel Cormier, the man who just lost to John Jones, as kind of the three light heavyweights who are clearly a cut above the rest of the division. And the night's other winner, Ryan Bader, now seems to be inhabiting that space between those three and the champion and the bottom half of the top 10. The back-to-back wins over Phil Davis and Ovin St. Preux for Bader is the most impressive run of his career in terms of name value. And then you throw in that he came in off these epic one-sided beatings of Rafael Cavalcante and Anthony Perroche that I believe one of them set a record for. I believe the Anthony Perroche fight was the most significant strikes ever dealt out in a fight. At this point, Ryan Bader has pretty much punched his entry to top five light heavyweight. And I think it's something that his growth as a fighter is overlooked by many MMA fans and even pundits, because when a fighter kind of either improves or has trouble with their growth, you'll hear a lot of terms like underrated or exposed or overhyped be thrown around. And there's not often a lot of recognition that a fighter is steadily getting better, and often in very small ways. When you hit that level of fighting, when you're already a top 10 fighter, your game is going to improve by millimeters. It's no longer going to be the big leaps and strides that we're used to seeing young fighters make. Ryan Bader is very kind of slowly improving. And if you go back and look at it, he's a radically different man than the one who fought on the Frank Mir versus Big Nogueira season of The Ultimate Fighter. And now this most recent fight was not his most impressive performance against Davis. And there may be – he may be hampered. I believe Power MMA lost their boxing coach. He left the team. And that may have kind of contributed to Ryan Bader not looking as impressive in this fight as he has in the past. But to me, what this fight really highlighted is the continuing struggles of Phil Davis. Because there was a time when Phil Davis was an exciting prospect in the light heavyweight division who really challenged the metagame at that weight class that was just full of powerful wrestlers who were all content to stand up and strike. You had, you know, Rampage and Rashad Evans and Chuck Liddell and all, and even like Shogun Hua was a striker. All these guys who just wanted to be on the feet and exchange punches. And Davis instead was a really dynamic ground fighter. And he was really, you know, he had this wonderfully creative knack from getting that side control hammerlock on Tim Boach to climbing the cage when he anaconda choked Alexander Gustafsson, which, I mean, that's 5 years ago at this point. And I think it's pretty clear that Anthony Davis is intent on becoming an outside striker and works a style that is in utter conflict with his actual fighting strengths. Even in college wrestling, Phil Davis was never really like a great outside shot guy. And by fighting consistently on the outside, he's basically killing his own takedown game. He takes his own wrestling out of the equation by fighting on the outside so frequently. And that would be fine, except for the fact that his strikes are rarely powerful. And when he does win with this style, it's often by very, very narrow decisions that really could go either way. And while Davis has most certainly become a slightly more technical fighter in terms of striking than he was when he started, it's been at the cost of the rest of his MMA game. He never fights on the inside, and he almost never chain wrestles in any of his fights. And at this point, he's really stopped showing growth as a fighter. And coming in, a lot of people tagged this fight for kind of playing out the way it did, because Ryan Bader, while a fairly good boxer by MMA standards with some decent power in his right hand, really wouldn't have the ability to track down Phil Davis, who would be on the outside working his kind of like, you know, elusive-ish style. And Phil Davis just didn't have a single strike in his arsenal that was a threat to hurt Ryan Bader. You combine Phil Davis's inability to keep growing, the continued defensive woes of Alexander Gustafsson, and then Miles Jury having a really disappointing performance against Donald Cerrone. And this has been a really rough start to 2015 for Alliance. Once thought to be one of the premier camps in all of MMA, and now they really seem to have regressed, because at this point, everyone in that camp is trying to strike like Dominick Cruz, who is the standout from that. And pretty much everyone who can't strike like him either then regresses as a striker or ends up leaving and going somewhere else. And at this point, the camp really seems to be, in general, aside from Dominick Cruz, stuck in second gear. And it really seems to be a problem for that particular camp. All right, so that about wraps up that. And for the next part, we're going to move into the in-depth segment. And, well, while I'm more of a grappling person myself, I've done a tiny bit of striking. To talk about things at this level, I need to bring in someone who legitimately knows what they're talking about when it comes to hitting other people. So to that end, I bring in Bloody Elbow writer and host of the Heavy Hands podcast, which if you're not listening to it, you need to be. Connor Rebush, to talk the finer points of the face punching that occurred last night. Connor, how are you doing?
I'm great. You know, I think that might be the first time I've ever been introduced with my name pronounced correctly. It is, in fact, Rebush, and it doesn't look like it, so I wouldn't blame anyone, but it's nice to hear it said that way from someone else's lips.
You've corrected me enough times that I think it finally sunk in.
Have I? I don't usually correct people. I'm sorry. I feel bad now.
I got it right, so clearly it worked. So I just got done kind of talking about the state of the light heavyweight division and my impressions, and obviously Anthony Johnson just put a beating on Alexander Gustafsson, and I went out there and I kind of looked at Gustafsson's lifetime stats as a striker, and just kind of on my own observations, I'm out there saying he's not really a sound defensive fighter and pretty much covers it up with offensive output. Where would you kind of come in from your viewpoint on that?
No, I think that's absolutely the case. Not that In fact, you know what? Gustafsson looked okay defensively in this fight. He actually made some movements that I don't normally see him make. He bobbed under a couple of hooks. He used his jab nicely to intercept Johnson. I think it kind of there wasn't obviously a lot of data to draw from. The fight was so brief, but it looked like he'd been working on a few things. But this is kind of something we see with a lot of long and tall fighters, where it's so easy for them against most opponents, and this is true even at the championship level. It's so easy for them to keep the majority of opponents at bay and to use the length of their limbs and to just lean back and suddenly be out of the opponent's reach that they don't really develop a layered defense. And so when opponents are good enough to get past that first layer, the reach, they start to have trouble. And it's even easier in MMA because the octagon is just so vast. You know, there's so much space to run around in. It's very, very difficult to really pin a tall guy down. But I mean, if you watch Vladimir Klitschko, he's the greatest heavyweight in the world right now. He's a top 10 all-time heavyweight, in fact. That will upset some people, but it's the truth. And yet, when people get inside on Vladimir Klitschko successfully, he's uncomfortable because he's tall and he's long-limbed and he's not used to it happening. So I think that's absolutely the case with Gustafsson.
Yeah, I noticed there was one moment, actually the eye poke, when he ended up accidentally poking Rumble in the eyes. To me, the replay, it looked like Gustafsson kind of did like a panicked parry off of Anthony Johnson feint. He was not comfortable in the range of fighting it.
He ducked his head. He lowered his eyes and looked away from Johnson and stuck both hands out away from his face. It was definitely not the defense of a man who is confident in his ability to stand in front of you and make you miss.
Yeah, and then on the other side of the cage, you have Anthony Johnson, who's just, I mean, historically, he's a really, really accurate and powerful striker, even going back to like the welterweight days. And I talked a bit about him working with Henry Hooft, and I alluded to improvements that he's been making under Hooft's tutelage. But who better to talk about like what actually has been going on recently with Anthony Johnson's game to make him like so much more effective?
Well, I think Hooft has helped bring Rumble down to a pace that suits him a little better. I think that Johnson used to gas himself out. You know, granted, he was a man who should have been 220 pounds walking around on fight night at, you know, trying to come near 170, not always with great success, but he was under 180 when he should have been over 200. And so you can attribute some of his stamina issues to that. But even then, in some of his heavyweight bouts, for example, when he fought Andrei Arlovsky in World Series of Fighting, Rumble was gassing in the third round because that fight was an all-out, back-and-forth, knockdown, drag-out war. It was just tons and tons of exchanges. And I think that Hooft has done a great job sort of paring down his game so that he doesn't feel the need to be constantly swinging back, which also means that he's at a little bit greater distance, so he's not constantly in the pocket being hit. And a lot of fighters have sort of confidence issues. I know it sounds strange when you think of Anthony Johnson to say he has confidence issues, but it's quite possible that he's a guy who doesn't like being hit. It's almost like it's an insult to the ego to be hit, and some guys respond to that by breaking. Other guys respond to that by covering it up with just extreme machismo and just swinging wild and going nuts, and that's what Johnson used to do. He would get tagged in the pocket. He would go just absolutely bananas trying to knock your head off for daring to touch him. And Hooft has really calmed that down a lot. On a technical level, I think one of the most notable things we've seen from the post-Hooft Anthony Johnson is his tactical stance switching. And that's because he's much less of an aggressive fighter now. He pressures a lot, but he doesn't tend to lead. He doesn't actually lead very well. He likes to counter, and he likes to get you out of position and then hit you, and he uses his pressure to do that. You start kind of throwing strikes desperately to get him away, and then he hits you back, and it usually hurts. And one of the things that makes him so dangerous with that is his stance switching, where Johnson will actually square his feet up right in front of his opponent, and then when they throw at him in this seemingly vulnerable position, just take a step to the side, and suddenly, depending which way he moves, he's either in southpaw or orthodox, and he's ready to throw a big right hand, either as a hook or as a cross, or a big left head kick, which, you know, is one of his favorite techniques. And so we've seen this in history with a lot of great aggressive counterpunchers, guys like Harold Bomber Graham and Prince Nassim Hamed. Mike Tyson switched stances all the time. And I think that's part of what makes Johnson seem so accurate now, is because once he does lay his hands on you, it's very difficult to get away from him. And Gustafsson definitely found that to be the case. In fact, when Johnson had Gustafsson reeling near the fence before he went down for the final time, Johnson actually ended up in southpaw and was throwing his right uppercuts and hooks from that stance as lead hand attacks, and it was cutting off the route to which Gustafsson would normally escape to his left. And it's just that sort of flexibility of stance that that makes Johnson such a difficult man to get away from.
Yeah, Hooft really feels like one of those – he's kind of establishing himself as one of those special coaches inside the MMA sphere, because he's so good at kind of building games for guys and kind of leading into their strengths. And I think especially with the two alliance fighters kind of in there, and I think Alexander Gustafsson actually fights pretty well to his strengths, but man, Phil Davis just, it continues to kind of disappoint. And I really kind of see his style of like attempting to imitate Dominic Cruz. It just is so counter to what he does well as a fighter, and he's not like the most brilliant takedown artist in the world, but like a little bit of inside fighting from Phil Davis would be a huge improvement for him, I think. And he just does not do it.
Sure. He landed some great shots on the break when he was fighting Ryan Bader, and it was like a glimmer of the greatness that could have been, because it's hard to find a better inside clinch wrestler and a better rider than Phil Davis. And yet his striking is all outside striking. You know, it's almost like it's complete luck when he manages to land a shot in close. And granted, everybody needs to be able to strike on the outside, but when I watch Phil Davis, I'm just constantly looking for distance closing tools that aren't there. All of his attacks are to maintain the distance, which is counterintuitive to what you'd like to see him doing. You know what I mean? Like, it would be nice to see him parrying a jab and then stepping inside of it and locking you up in a body lock, because that's where Davis is a killer. It would be nice to see him slipping outside a right hand and stepping his right foot forward and blasting you off your feet with a double leg, where he can just ride you into oblivion on the ground. Instead, we've got Davis as a sort of fleet-footed kickboxer who he generally makes people look bad. He's got, you know, it says a lot about Anthony Johnson that he looked pretty good against Phil Davis, because I think we know by now nobody looks good against Phil Davis. But then again, Phil Davis never looks very good himself. He always looks uncomfortable with what he's doing. And I think on a certain level, Davis sort of feels like he doesn't have an end game. He doesn't have a game plan in mind. And, you know, tactically speaking, when we mention Henri Hooft, it's quite the opposite. All of the guys that he's worked with at the Black Zillions, we've seen a ton of examples of him really suiting their styles as they kind of rebuild themselves under his tutelage. He's suited their styles to their personalities and their physical attributes very well, so that they fight in a way that really works for them personally. And fighting styles are always personal. And so when you have everybody at Alliance trying to be Gustafsson and Dominic Cruz, guaranteed, if you guys aren't going to fit that mold.
Yeah, no, I think Hooft is just doing a fantastic job at the Black Zillions, and in general, that camp has really become, I feel like, one of the more professional in terms of like management and how it's run, from coaching to the PR staff and my interactions with them. I mean, an MMA camp with a PR staff is
sure.
Yeah, that's pretty hard to come by.
I followed the Black Zillions on Twitter the other day, and I got a message that said, "Thanks for joining the team. Go to our website." I'm like, wow. Nobody's that professional in MMA. Yeah. Nobody does that. I think the one weakness with Hooft is that he's a very, very tactical coach, and it leaves his guys open to being sort of figured out.
Yeah.
And where he's like, for example, when Eddie Alvarez fought Donald Cerrone, Alvarez was kind of dead in the water after the first round because he had success, but once Cerrone started warming up and adjusting to what Alvarez was doing, the only things Hooft was telling Eddie in the corner were, you know, how to get around his kicks, for example, to move around his kicks and how to land this shot and stuff like that. He didn't give him very many suggestions of what would be really the best, safest way to hold on to the lead and win this fight. It was all, here's how you counter his kicks. Well, you probably shouldn't try to counter Donald Cerrone's kicks, to be honest, if you're that much smaller than him. But Hooft is always thinking about, okay, I know there's a way to beat that technique, so here's how you beat it. And often overlooks the fact that maybe you shouldn't try to beat that technique at all and should try something different.
Yeah, I think the thing that's really the Black Zillions, I think the final piece for that camp is going to be getting like that really good head coach. And I know Jorge Santiago is currently in that place, and I would wonder if he settles more into like grappling coach territory, because I think the real standout guy from that camp, who I think has like A+ head coaching material written all over him, is Rashad Evans. I think Rashad Evans is just, in terms of how he thinks about MMA and how he kind of was on that like cutting edge of like developing transitions, he clearly is kind of, and generally the way he fought too, he always fought with a very strategic eye. I think Rashad Evans is kind of like the head coach in waiting at the Black Zillions.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I wish I knew more about Rashad in a coaching capacity, so I could, you know, speak more confidently about how we do. But just as a sort of one-off assessment, it seems like a guy who would be really promising in that role.
Yeah. So let's move into the co-main event of the evening. And we were talking about being figured out. And if there's something that's been figured out at this point, it's Dan Henderson's right hand. There was a time when Dan Henderson's right hand was absolutely feared. And I think people need to start coming back to the idea that, you know, Michael Bisping versus Dan Henderson is almost 6 years ago at this point, and we're at kind of a different stage of MMA striking. And Gegard Mousasi was just so easily ducking and slipping the few right hands Dan Henderson was able to get off in that minute and 10 seconds that I really don't feel like Dan Henderson was going to have any success in that fight. Connor, as someone who trains in the Sweet Science, how easy is it to prepare for someone who really has one punch?
With Dan Henderson, I think it's almost always been more of a mental threat than an actual physical one, because Dan himself is not exactly great at closing the distance. I mean, he can burst forward with surprising speed, but he doesn't really have a ton of great setups. He has that little inside leg kick that everybody at Quest, Team Quest, likes so much, and sometimes he'll jab. And if he lands the right hand, he'll follow with a hook sometimes, so that's kind of gone away too. But really, I mean, you can tell by the way I'm talking about it, there's not a lot of nuance to what Dan Henderson does on the feet. And the scary thing about fighting Dan Henderson is that right hand was always just like cocked on his shoulder next to his jaw like a bazooka. And Dan was really good at giving the impression of being ready to hit you. And I think the more we see him against opponents with reach advantages or better straight punching ability or better footwork or just, you know, 20 more years of youth on him, we see how limited that kind of thing really is. Because, you know, Mousasi was he had absolutely no difficulty figuring out when Henderson was going to throw his right hand. And I suppose if I have to look at one thing, I have to attribute that to Mousasi's positioning, because he was constantly putting himself where his left foot was pointed right at Dan Henderson's center line, at his crotch, basically. It's where you want to point your lead toes when you're striking with someone. And the jab lines up with that lead foot. So the moment somebody steps in, you don't even have to throw it hard. You can just stick out your left hand, and they're going to run face first into it. And Mousasi did that. Henderson was chasing him across the entire octagon and eating 2, 3, 4 jabs on the way, and either being completely discouraged or being so far away because he was on the end of Mousasi's punch that Mousasi had plenty of time and space to react basically any way he wanted to that right hand. And Mousasi slipped it, what, 2 or 3 times, moved his head to the outside or circled away from it, and by then he became comfortable with the timing of it. He hit Henderson with the jab. Henderson kept coming forward. It was obvious he was going to throw the right, and so Mousasi, as he slipped left, just brought a right hand along with it and countered Dan right in the temple and dropped him. You just need more. You need more, and it's not a matter of moves. I don't like to think of fighting in terms of moves, like it's a video game, but it's a matter of concepts. And you've got to give the guy something to worry about, or you've got to put something in his face to cover his vision, or you've got to move a certain way. There has to be a different threat when a fighter is good enough to neutralize the one threat that you have.
Yeah, you can have kind of that centerpiece of your game, and especially when you get into things like boxing, where I know a lot of boxing trainers like to say there's only so many punches you can throw. It's how you get to the punches that actually matters. You need more paths to your kind of the centerpiece of your offense than Dan Henderson has. And he kept showing the same – I mean, he basically kept showing Gegard Mousasi the same thing, and Mousasi is such a high-level striker. It took him approximately a minute to figure it out and land a nice hard counter.
And so cool-headed, too. I mean, Musasi's expression is not a lie. He's absolutely relaxed when he fights. I think his last fight with Jacare Souza might have been the only time I've ever seen him look really frustrated, because he takes everything in stride and handles it very well. And so the threat of Henderson's right hand is nothing to a fighter like that. He knows he can take it, and that confidence allows him to react in such a way that he never really has to. And so, I mean, look at Roy Nelson. That's a guy whose striking is effectively one-dimensional, but Roy Nelson's pretty damn good at putting that right hand on people's chins. He has his limitations, but he's still sort of making adjustments. He knows how to cover the distance. He will even wait for you to throw and then change levels, come in close, and bomb you over the top of your shoulder with the right. Henderson doesn't have any of those little subtle tricks to get into range. It's effectively just him throwing the right hand and hoping that it lands. And it just these days it just doesn't anymore.
Yeah, and I think honestly the biggest surprise from Gegard Mousasi that night actually came at the post-fight press conference, where he actually smiled for about 2 seconds.
Makwan Amirkhani had him cracking up.
Yeah. So, and actually I think that kind of talking about that transition, not the smiling, but like Dan Henderson unable to kind of adjust what he's doing, kind of leads nicely into the final thing I want to talk to you about in Albert Tumenov. Kind of adjusting himself on the fly in terms of Nicholas Musaki. Is that how you say his name?
I think it's Musoke, but Musoke? Who knows? I get half my pronunciations from Goldberg and Rogan, and God knows they don't do the research. So
yeah, and it's one of those times I usually just wait, if I'm on a show with Patrick, your co-host Patrick Wyman, I usually wait for him to say it first, and I just try to say it however he says it.
And you can blame him if it's wrong.
And it's never wrong, because he's like, you know, I don't know how, but he manages to like pronounce every name with like the proper, like even like the proper inflection and accent of the language of origin.
Do you know how hard I tried in my Patricio Pitbull Freire video to consistently say his name correctly? And I'm sure it still wasn't that good of a rendering.
And I can't roll my R's like that. But anyway, back to kicking and punching people. It was interesting because Tumenov kind of got off to a rough start in this fight. Obviously, he's kind of the hot kickboxer sort of fighter. He likes to come in. He's definitely more of a counter fighter. Am I correct in that? He likes to let guys come forward and work a bit.
Yeah, sure.
And Musoke was landing those body kicks, and obviously the Joe Rogan was making a huge deal out of the body kicks, whereas Tumenov seemed really content to try to catch them and throw a right hand back. But what really – his hands weren't really landing in the first round. What kind of changed from the first to second round that Tumenov really started teeing off?
I think Tumenov kind of realized that Musoke can't box. And I know that sounds like a really broad statement to make, but once he realized that he could, I call it penetrating the stance. And that's kind of something I borrowed from wrestling. In wrestling, there's a concept, there's a move, a technique called a penetration step.
Yes.
Where you're trying to step in and you're giving yourself basically room to drive forward and blast through the opponent's hips and get them off their feet. And it's not just about the deepness of the step, the depth of the step, it's also about the angle. And in striking, when you penetrate somebody's stance, you're not just stepping straight forward, you're stepping around their lead foot and then moving to the inside of it. And suddenly you find yourself in a position where you can hit them with power and they're not going to take those shots well because their feet are square, they don't have their balance, and they can't really throw with good power back at you. And so your straight punches beat whatever they throw it all day. And Tumenov kind of keyed in on that after a little while. The body kicks, by the way, were beautiful. Musoke did an excellent job with those kicks. And Tumenov was trying to move forward and ended up stepping into these kicks. And even when he caught him, I don't really see that as being an equal exchange. But suddenly, in the second round, the distance in this fight became dramatically less. Tumenov just started standing closer and closer to Musoke. And by the end of the fight, Musoke was not comfortable throwing his kicks anymore, because Tumenov was just standing close to him. Musoke felt like he had to throw a jab or a right hand, something to get Tumenov to back off. And when he did, Tumenov would slip or just simply sidestep around it and hit him with punches from that inside angle. And Yeah, it was a nice display of footwork. I mean, Tumenov was putting himself a little bit at risk. He was a little off balance with how aggressively he pursued some of those angles. But like I said, I think he keyed in pretty quickly onto the fact that Muzoke couldn't catch him with his punches if he just moved around him.
Yeah, I love fights like this. The same reason I actually really enjoyed Conda Diaz is I love watching a fight where you get a guy who's kind of where you get like that little tiny distance game where one guy wants the fight to be in kicking distance and the other guy wants it to be in boxing distance, and watching them try to play with that particular, like, how do you suck the guy into your game?
Yeah,
it was a really, really fun fight, and I thought one of the better fights of the evening.
Yeah, it was an absolute blast. And the one thing that really stood out to me about this fight, I'll go on a rant here, is how poorly Muzoke defended punches despite the fact that his hands were constantly glued to his temples. And this is something I get into a lot of arguments about, because it's one of, you know, hands up is one of the things you'll hear bandied about in every boxing gym you ever go to. You'll hear every single commentator say it, especially when somebody gets knocked down, because it makes you sound like you know what you're talking about, even if you don't. So if a guy gets knocked down, invariably, because he's fighting and throwing punches, one of his hands is not going to be near his chin. And so the commentator gets to sound smart and say, ah, see, he got hit because his hands were down. He didn't bring his hands back fast enough. There's a lot more to defense than constantly having your hands up by your face. And, you know, if I stand in front of you with my hands down by my nipples and I say, punch me in the face, you can hit me in the face. And if I do the same thing and I put my hands by my ears and put the earmuffs on and say, punch me in the face, you can punch me in the face. Nothing really changes. And in fact, I open up parts of my body that previously were not open. And by the same token, if I put my hands down at my chest and say, punch me in the face, and you try and then I parry your punch, that is no different than if my hands are up and I tell you to punch and I parry your punch. It may take me a fraction of a second less to parry from the hands up position, but it's not as if it's impossible to stop punches using your hands just because your hands are slightly lower than they should be. And I think this was a great example of how easy it really is for a good striker, which Albert Tumenov absolutely is, to work around a static high guard. Because if you just put your hands up, That's basically the antithesis of the threat of Dan Henderson's right hand. Dan Henderson, for all his limitations, always looks like he's ready to hit you back. And Nico Muzoke always looked like he was desperate to stop you hitting him. It's not a very threatening proposition to walk in on a guy like that and throw your hands at him. And Tumenov was hitting him with his left hand from underneath, and then the right hand would come over the top. He was moving side to side and sneaking punches around and through the guard. And the entire time, Muzoke's hands just stayed there. It's almost as if his entire life, he's gone into gyms and people have said, hey, keep your hands up. And he did a great job of it, and it didn't stop the punches. So I'm not against blocking punches. I'm not even against shelling up when absolutely necessary. It burns me sometimes to hear something as nuanced and complicated as striking defense being described as if it can be accomplished just by putting your hands closer to your head. It doesn't happen that easily.
And I think the case in point of that is Alistair Overeem's defensive ability.
Like, right.
He just puts his hands up and he gets knocked out doing it all the time.
He has confidence almost that if he puts his hands up, it's going to stop what's coming at him. And any striker worth his salt can get around that. It's just not enough.
And I think you made an excellent point about the idea that Dan Henderson, the way he carries himself, there is a threat of a counterattack. And we're talking about this idea of distance, and they threw it around on the broadcast a lot that, oh, like Alexander Gustafsson, he's trying to get Anthony Johnson's respect early. And I really think that when you're talking about defense in the striking realm, part of what keeps a guy from just crashing down off you is the threat of a counterattack. Because I think that's one of the things that, like, if you get into a gym and you're striking for the first time, the first thing that shocks you is that no one approaches you the way you like when you watch a boxing match, because no one cares about your defense or your ability to counterpunch until you make them care. And an aggressive posture, like looking like you're in a position to hit them back, will get them to kind of back off a little bit and be slightly more careful.
Absolutely. No, I couldn't agree more. And I'll make brief mention of another fight that also helps to drive that point home, which was Sam Cecilia versus Akira Korasani was the main card opener. And I already said this on Twitter when the fight was going on, but I don't mind repeating myself. Akira Korasani has been knocked out enough times and hurt by enough punches, and it's happened now 3 fights in a row that he's been stopped in violent fashion. So I think he's got a confidence issue going on where he no longer looks comfortable exchanging with people. And I said during the fight that if you approach an opponent as if you can't afford to be hit, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you feel like if he hits you, it's going to be over, then it's going to happen. It's just the way it is. And when Akira Korasani was throwing back at Sam Cecilia, there was just nervousness and tension. He was flinching. He was ducking his head. He was taking his eyes off of Cecilia. He was making himself a target. Whereas had he, for example, stayed his ground and kept his eyes on Cecilia and stuck a jab in his face the moment Cecilia thought about throwing the right hand, the way that Musasi did to Dan Henderson, Cecilia would have thought twice about coming in with the same approach again. The counter is so absolutely crucial, and it's one of the worst things about modern boxing that we've got these big gloves and everybody's being told to keep their hands up, and nobody's being told that, look, if you make a miss and hit him back, that's 10 times better for defensive purposes because now he's going to think twice about doing it to you again. Whereas if you just put your hands up and he's really good, he's probably going to get through at some point or another.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. Awesome. Are there any other fighters or fights that really stuck out to you before I let you go?
Konstantin Arokin was disappointing.
Oh,
that was a real bummer. And I feel bad. I advise people to bet on that fight. This is why I shouldn't ever make betting advice ever again. I was right with the Ryan Bader pick. Bader did beat Davis, but it was shocking to see Arokin, a talented, athletic heavyweight from Russia, of all places, with no wrestling ability. How do you come from Russia and not know how to wrestle?
I'm going to admit I only saw the bad portions of this fight. I apparently missed the early goings of it, in which Rokin actually looked competent and was hitting.
Yeah.
And we had this discussion on the MMA Prospectus, which is with myself, Zane Simon, and Patrick Wyman. And this Friday, Zane and I are going to have to hear about a million I told you so's from Patrick, because he called this fight to a T. Zane was very, very high on him, Rokin. I was high on him also, but I feel like I was a bit more tempered. Because there are problems with Arokin's style, and I mean, he's beaten, like, he hasn't beaten, like, world beaters on the regional scene, but I mean, when you get a guy who's beaten, like, Brett Rogers and Dave Huckabee,
yeah.
I mean, the fact that they wrote him off as a can crusher, the fact that Joe Rogan wrote him off as a can crusher, to me, shows that Joe Rogan, like, doesn't do much more than look at the guy's record and his method of victory. Because
I don't think Joe Rogan does that. I think Joe Rogan looks at the paper they put in front of him when he sits down to call the fights.
Yeah, no, it's getting this show, not to get into that, because this last show was particularly bad for Rogan. But
yeah.
I think one of the things you see is just the general durability of high level fighters. It's hard to finish guys at this level. There are guys who can just take beatings. And Arokin really didn't have a backup plan, and his wrestling is not great, and his ground fighting's even worse. So I still think that he has some time. I mean, he's 33, but he's only been fighting for, what, like 2 or 3 years at this point?
I think he absolutely has time, and I think that we could easily see Arokin still be a challenger for the heavyweight title within the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
He's got the skills to be competitive with the heavyweights on the feet. All he needs now is to supplement that. You know, if we could get Arokin over to train with Mark Hunt and whoever taught Mark Hunt his, I think I called it bowling ball with underhooks takedown defense style.
Yep.
I mean, that would be great for Arokin. If he could just, he didn't take the, Luke Thomas mentioned on Twitter very correctly that Arokin didn't take the battle for underhooks seriously, where Pesta got in on his leg, and he was just kind of waiting for Pesta to let go. And he just didn't have those prescriptive notions about grappling in the clinch that you need to stop a guy who's really tenacious and determined to get you to the mat.
No, if you're going to – and if there's a division where you're going to kind of have a comeback or have a long growth, it's heavyweight. I mean – as you just, we had Mark Hunt and Fabricio Werdum, two guys who were fighting in Pride, fighting for the interim heavyweight belt. late last year. I mean, there's time, and Nikita Krylov, Nikki Thrills, just
Nikki Thrills.
Nikki Thrills just looked competent in an MMA fight. Like, he looked like a competent wrestler against Stanislav Netkov. I mean,
yeah.
It's if you're an athlete and you have some time to develop, you can be competitive in the sport. It's just not necessarily going to happen right away. So I think Orokin still has time. I feel like you're kind of more on with Zane in terms of where Orokin's like end game is. I kind of see him as more of like a middle dweller for the heavyweight division, maybe kind of cracking that top 15. Zane is kind of with you. He thinks Orokin ends up being in the top 10 at some point, just because, I mean, it's heavyweight.
Mm-hmm. I think he's got the potential. I won't say it with too much confidence because, again, it's heavyweight. But I definitely think he has the potential. And the guy who beat him, Pesta, is a great example of how fighters can grow from one fight to the next. You know, I didn't expect him to be that tenacious. I didn't expect him – he didn't look amazing by any means. But he took a hell of a beating, and he still stayed in there, and he did what he needed to do to get a well-deserved win. So, although one judge gave him 30-27, what's up with that? Anyway.
I mean, at this point, is it even surprising?
I mean, I could be pissed off all day if I dwelled on MMA too much.
Only one judge in the Mirsad Bektik fight gave him 10-8 rounds.
Yeah,
that's insane. But yeah. So all right, well, thank you very much for joining me, and for all of you out there listening, be sure to check it out. Heavy Hands Podcast. It goes up on Thursdays, right, or is it Wednesdays?
It's Wednesdays now. You can find all our episodes on HeavyHandsPodcast.com. And this week, Patrick Wyman and I are going to be talking, well, the aftermath of Gustafson and Johnson, because there's a lot of implications there and a lot of fun technique to talk about from that fight. But of course, Anderson Silva versus Nick Diaz. It's been a good month for MMA, so I'm just hoping that it continues to build an excitement as it has so far. And yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for coming, and hope to have you again. And if you're not listening to Heavy Hands, you're not doing MMA fan right.
Thanks, man.
All right, again, thank you to Connor Rebush for coming on here. I had planned to talk a little bit Mirsad Bektik at the end of this show, but considering that Connor and I went a little bit over, I think I'll leave that for the MMA prospectus, which you can check out on Fridays here at Bloody Elbow. If you follow me on Twitter, @TP_Grant, I will post the link to the live show. We do it on Google Hangouts every Friday evening. If you actually have something resembling a social life on Fridays and don't feel like listening to me talk to two other guys on the internet about prospects in cage fighting, I can perfectly understand that. And we post the actual video on YouTube very quickly after concluding the show. And then we actually do an official post on bloodyelbow.com, usually on Saturday morning. So you can check that out. We will most likely be talking about, we absolutely will be talking about any prospects worth checking out on the Diaz versus Anderson Silva card and kind of recapping prospect performances on this most recent card. And you'll get to hear Patrick Wyman tell me and Zane Simon, I told you so about Orokin's performance, and we'll probably make fun of him for Mike Rhodes. And who knows, maybe you'll see the destruction of the show and us break up right there live on air. So be sure to tune in. Thank you for joining me this week on Inside the Guard. We will be back for Anderson Silva versus Nick Diaz, and I'm anticipating a lot to talk about after that card. Have a great week.